Our present faculty organization plan, adopted last year, requires that the president make an annual report to the faculty on the state of the university, and that this annual reporting take the place of the winter term meeting of the Faculty Senate. This is the first of such annual reports. The Faculty Steering Committee thought it desirable to invite to this meeting interested members of faculty families and a representative group of student leaders. They have a vital interest in the state of the university, and we're happy to have them here. The public, too, has a real interest in what is being done on this campus. And to represent that interest, elected state officials and elected representatives of county and local governmental units have been told that they, too, are welcome. This is a public university, and the public interest must always be kept in mind. We are here this evening to counsel together as men and women engaged in the great enterprise of education, in the service of a great university, bearing a burden of increasing responsibility to the society by which it is maintained. Certain limitations are automatically imposed by the nature of this occasion. A single hour is too short a time to review and comment adequately on an enterprise as vast and complex as this university. To review or comment adequately upon the off-campus programs in continuing education and cooperative extension alone would require more than an hour. The need for evaluation, coordination, and redirection in these areas is among the most challenging and important problems facing this university and deserves and requires early attention. The world seems to shrink in size continually. It becomes increasingly evident that our domestic welfare is increasingly intertwined with the welfare of all people everywhere. The international dimension of Michigan State University and the importance of the maintenance and expansion of this dimension in almost everything we do is worthy of separate coverage. In international education, this university is generally recognized as being at least even with the foremost of our great American universities. My problem this evening is how to cover as much as we can in the time available in a manner to stimulate all of us to want to push on with the important on-campus work before us, leaving for another occasion off-campus education, our international interests, and a definitive discussion of our role in research for the acquisition of new knowledge and our role in research as a stimulant to state economic activity. One obvious approach is the selection of some benchmarks from which to calculate our present position, our direction of movement, and our rate of progress toward fixed objectives. The founders of this university, more than 100 years ago, defined in clear terms what they wanted this institution to become. One of them, Bela Hubbard, insisted that it should be no mere technological school, but that the new college should offer an enlightened liberal education in the belief that minds trained in the liberal tradition would be able to observe, to judge, and to draw sound conclusions. And he embedded liberal education in our tradition with these words, quote, "Nor should the claims of literature and the fine arts be wholly neglected as tending to polish the mind and manners, refine the taste, and add greater luster and dignity to life," end of the quote. Hubbard in 1850 was talking about education for the sons of farmers to make them not only better farmers, but also better men and better citizens of this fledgling state on the frontier of a new country. 12 years later, Congress passed and President Lincoln signed the Morrill Act, establishing a college in every state after this Michigan pattern. The institutions established as a consequence of that grant of public lands we know today as the land-grant colleges, and the educational philosophy to which they subscribe as the land-grant philosophy. Not only was this university the true pioneer of the land-grant college movement, but also the true intent of Hubbard's words were included in the Morrill Act in the provision that these new colleges, and this is a quote from the Act, without excluding other scientific and classical studies, should teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions of life. End of the quote. The faculty of the early years heeded Hubbard's injunction faithfully. The catalog of 1877, 20 years after this institution's opening, reveals a prescribed set of courses for all students. And they included technical courses in agriculture, horticulture, mechanics, civil engineering, surveying, and bookkeeping, plus courses in algebra, geometry, trigonometry, history, composition, rhetoric, botany, chemistry, physiology, physics, entomology, meteorology, zoology, English literature, French, mental philosophy, moral philosophy, political economy, and logic. 86 years ago, all students on this campus were required to take at least one full year of instruction in French. All of them were studying science and technology, and all of them were studying the humanities too. And this university continues to insist that our students be broadly trained, that they not be crammed into narrow molds, that they be encouraged to develop the values and to acquire the experiences without which they cannot validly claim to be educated men and women. Michigan State University believes that education must be built on a broad base and that narrowing specialization should be delayed until increasing maturity and knowledge can accept and manage it gracefully. And this gives us one benchmark. In search of another, we could digress into a consideration of the tantalizing question, what is a university? But the question before us tonight is, what is this university? And one of the most applauded definitions of a university was written by Cardinal Newman a century ago. In his words, quote, "It is a place in which the intellect may safely range and speculate, sure to find its equal in some antagonist activity, and its judge in the tribunal of truth. It is a place where inquiry is pushed forward and discoveries verified and perfected, and rashness rendered innocuous, and error exposed by the collision of mind with mind and knowledge with knowledge." The end of the Newman quote. But in spite of its clarity and depth of understanding of the character of a university, Newman's definition is incomplete. Here on this campus, our predecessors helped to add a new dimension to higher education in the establishment of an institution to serve a new social purpose, not then identified in Europe, only dimly perceived by American educators, and still in 1963, not fully accepted by some educational traditionalists. Today, after 108 years, we accept the American university as one of the educational instrumentalities created and maintained by society through which it seeks to accomplish certain social objectives. Our society builds universities, staffs them with able scholars, equips them with books and apparatus, and then to a selected group of its young citizens, it says, "You will be excused for a period of years from the common necessity to labor and support yourselves. You will be admitted to the public universities without great expense to yourselves, where you will be expected to apply yourselves diligently to the courses of study laid out for you by your professors. And this special dispensation is granted to you in order that you may develop your innate capacities, become skilled in professions and occupations of your own choice, and eventually re-enter the world beyond the campus as adult citizens who are more productive economically, more judicious politically, more sensitive morally, and more responsive socially than you would have been had you not been encouraged to acquire college educations. Through you, our society intends to improve itself, to raise its standard of living, enrich its culture, strengthen its political fabric, and elevate its social tone. This is the way our society seeks to provide the equality of opportunity to which it is pledged. In this way, it seeks to build towards a better tomorrow. If we accept this larger definition, then we who serve Michigan State University agree that through this university, we serve these broader social purposes. The university does not belong to the students. It does not belong to the faculty. It does not belong to the administration or even to the trustees. Michigan State University belongs to the people of Michigan who established it, who have nurtured it through the long decades, and who continue to sustain it. In the final analysis, Michigan State University belongs to the larger social organization that is the nation, and of which the state of Michigan is but a part. No one group of the thousands of individuals associated with the university has the exclusive right to dictate how the university shall be operated. Neither may any one segment make decisions in isolation in order to serve its own selfish purposes. All decisions affecting the university should be made in the light of the university's first and only responsibility to serve society. Under our system of government, the trustees bear the ultimate responsibility for all decisions. They are the most immediately responsible to the electorate. They are trustees of the public interest. But although the trustees bear the final responsibility to the people of Michigan, all of us, as academic officers of this university, share in the responsibility to conduct its affairs so that it serves society faithfully. Traditionally, we accept without question three major roles as appropriate for a land-grant university: teaching, research, and extension. And I would emphasize that the greatest of these is teaching. And if we agree upon this concept of Michigan State University and these roles for it, then we have reliable benchmarks from which to calculate the pace at which the university is moving and the direction in which it is moving. And we have a course by which to steer in seeking our objectives and by which to correct our steering if we find that we have drifted offline. And this gives us a valuable reference, for example, when we come to decide the question of which students we shall admit to the university. And this is in turn part of the broader question of how many students we shall accept and how large this university should become. And assuming that we seek the good of Michigan, and not just the approval of other universities or our own comfort and convenience, we will admit our share of those students capable of being educated here to perform the multifarious tasks Michigan needs to have performed. Some of those tasks demand intellects of the highest quality, and we will seek out and encourage young people with such intellects and make available to them here the best educations of which we are capable. But not all human activities demand the services of geniuses. Lesser mortals, too, can perform other tasks also of great importance to society. And if college educations of good quality are required to prepare those other able young people for useful roles, then they, too, should be admitted to Michigan State University. Those who can qualify who cannot qualify for nor profit from a college education should be excluded. And the danger does not lie in placing admission standards too low, but in raising them so high that we automatically limit the usefulness of the university itself. No one questions but that we should continue to search out and welcome all of the students we can find who rank in potential ability in the upper 10% of their age group. But we would err badly and deny our historic obligation if we were to reject all those a notch below or possibly several notches below the genius class. Each group benefits from association with the other. Both can be accommodated honorably within a great public university, having ambitions to emphasize excellence in everything it undertakes. All of us are pleased with a sharp increase in the quality of our entering freshmen as measured by high school grades and test scores. Dr. Sabine tells us that 76% of this year's freshman class ranked in the top 25% of their high school classes, and that 33% of them ranked in the top 10% of their classes, and that some 250 of them were valedictorians or salutatorians of their classes. Certainly, we're getting better students now on the average than those of 5 years ago or 10 years ago or before that. Presumably, we are doing a better job of teaching and inspiring them. With brighter students and better teaching, it seems to me illogical that we see no reflection of either change in the academic grades we record. I am disturbed when Dean Winburn tells me that almost 40% of all freshmen are one or more grade points below a full C average, and that 25% of all sophomores have less than a full C average, and that these figures have not dropped as the quality of our students has improved. And so I ask the question, is our grading system right? If it is right, then are we unrealistic in requiring a C average for advancement to the upper college or for graduation? Perhaps we should examine the practices of the prestigious universities, which assume that their rigid and highly selective admission standards, that with those standards, all but the demonstrated non-performers will normally proceed to graduation. And in many of them, a numerical grade of 60 or a letter grade of D will meet minimum requirements. And I repeat, if 76% of our freshmen are graduated in the top 25% of their high school classes, is it logical that 40% of them should end the freshman year with less than C averages, and that after the non-performers are weeded out and the discouraged have dropped out voluntarily, that 25% of those remaining will not have C averages as sophomores? And I hope that our faculties will take another hard look at this problem. We know too little about our students and about what happens to them here. An interesting paper by Professor Elmel Troll of the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of California, Berkeley, identifies what he terms four major subcultures or student orientations on most campuses. First, there are the students interested primarily in fun and frolicking, social activities, athletics, and the like. And second, there are the students interested primarily in learning so that they may be able to get a better job. And third, there are the students interested primarily in knowledge, in ideas, in learning for learning's sake. And fourth, there is a very small group of students interested primarily in being consciously nonconformist in their search for self-identity. Now, we do not know in what proportion students coming to Michigan State fall into these four categories. We know we have some in all four. We do not know how or whether they change from one orientation to another while they are here. And I hope that we will continue to study the values and goals and beliefs of our students when they enter, and the impact of this university, the impact this university has upon them during their careers on this campus. Some significant and useful results may come from these studies, and the findings may enable us to do a better job of choosing our students and a better job of teaching them. Which groups of TROS 4 subcultures should we encourage to come to Michigan State University? Most of us would agree that we could be satisfied with a minimum number in the first subculture, that of the students interested primarily in fun, frolic, and the froth of student activities. And those in the fourth category, the consciously nonconformists, cause headaches for the dean of students and for the professors too. But this would be a duller place if we had none of them, and the state news would lack material for headlines and for its letters to the editor department. And many members of the faculty would be happy if we accepted only those in the third group named by Troll, those interested primarily in knowledge and ideas and learning for learning's sake. Such a situation would be one answer to the professor's prayer, but it cannot be the answer at a university with our dedication. We will continue to have our share of young people in the second category who come here because they see in a college education a way to improve themselves, a way to develop their native abilities, to earn a larger share of life's rewards than they could hope to enjoy without such education. And this university cannot say that there is no place for them here. This, as the Michigan Land-Grant University, was created for the purpose of equalizing opportunity for intelligent young citizens. It was created to be an instrument through which society improves itself by helping the members of that society to improve themselves so they can contribute in larger measures of what they have to give. It is obligated to provide a liberal and practical education for the several pursuits and professions of life. And are we at this public university going to say that due to the press of numbers, we prefer to move in the more convenient, less demanding direction of accepting only the most gifted students and only those interested in knowledge and learning for learning's sake? And you know the answer as well as I. If we're given the tools required, we must be interested in all able young people seriously interested in developing their potential to serve our society better. And the next question, in what numbers will our students come? The people of Michigan have been providing schools and teachers at great cost for ever-increasing numbers in our grade and high schools. And these numbers are about to deluge our colleges and universities. The number of Michigan high school graduates in the spring of 1965, 2 years from now, will be more than 40% higher than the number that graduated last spring. And there is nothing in the present picture to cause us to revise downward the estimate made from this platform 2 years ago that we may reasonably expect at least 35,000 students on this campus by 1970. And in fact, our best present predictions indicate that the number is more likely to be in the range of 39,000 to 41,000. And that estimate does not bring the gasps it once brought. We're learning how to live with bigness. We're not afraid of it, and we need not apologize for it. There are comparatively few other universities, public or private, able to handle large numbers as well as we do. The challenge of numbers to us has been a real stimulation, not something to fear. And we should take pride in the opportunity we have earned to be of so much direct service to so many. Now, this is not to say that we have reached any peak of educational perfection or that we can expect to handle tomorrow's requirements by just doing more of the same in the same old way. We must effect radical changes in our procedures if we are to accommodate the larger number of students headed our way, without diluting the quality of the education we can offer to them. And you'll remember that after the faculty convocation of March 1961, when some of our major problems were discussed, our Board of Trustees approved a suggested approach to some solutions for our problems. And this tentative blueprint gives us another benchmark by which to gauge our progress in converting this university into an institution capable of meeting the new demands being laid upon it. And this broad commitment has often been referred to as a seven-point program. And I'd like to refresh your memory and impose upon your good nature by reading again the seven specific proposals. One, it's proposed that students be encouraged to assume progressively some responsibility for their own learning, and that this encouragement be offered by giving earlier emphasis to acquiring learning skills and by far more comprehensive advising by faculty in the time released from repetitive and non-productive tasks. And two, it is proposed that we facilitate independent learning by defining educational objectives more concretely and specifically, and organizing courses and curricula to serve the purposes of the student. And three, it is proposed to redefine the responsibilities of faculty members with due reference to rank and the most productive use of their time. And four, it is proposed to put to use discoveries already made concerning the learning process itself, and to stimulate further research through the establishment of a learning resources center to include and encourage the use of closed circuit television, film, teaching machines, program studies, and other aids. And five, it is proposed to improve the environment for learning by making greater academic use of the residence halls and of the time students spend in them, thus eliminating as best we can physical inconvenience as an impediment to learning and capitalizing upon our great advantage as a residence university. And six, it is proposed to give consideration to designing a model for the university combining the advantages of comprehensiveness with the conveniences and identification of smaller groups. And seven, it is proposed that forward planning and budgeting be carried out by the several colleges and departments in a manner to give effect to these proposals, and that the Board of Trustees and officers allocate the financial resources of the university so as to support and encourage those colleges and departments actively engaging in the process of redesigning their programs in keeping with the overall development framework. Those were the 7 points. Now, our progress in the past 21 months has been less substantial than many of us had hoped for and expected. Perhaps we were too optimistic. Our fundamental need is not for structural alternatives, but for radical changes in our thinking, out of which would naturally grow the structural changes necessary to give effect to new ideas. And we've made only the smallest beginning on the enormous job of revamping our course structure. In the current catalog, we list 2,386 courses for undergraduates. 2,386. Can we continue to justify spreading such a proliferation of courses before our students when the individual student can, on the average, take only about 60 courses in his 4 undergraduate years? And we list 1,254 graduate courses. Are that many necessary when each master's degree candidate will, on the average, be able to take only about 15? And the doctoral candidates will take less than 3 times that number? And must we not ask ourselves how many of these courses are offered principally to demonstrate the versatility of our departments and faculty, rather than to serve the needs of students? Could we not do as well or better educationally with a radically reduced number of course offerings, with a substantial saving in faculty time and dollar costs? All available evidence points to the urgent necessity for establishing priorities. A very high priority must be given to selection from our vast array of offerings that which we need to teach, and then to teaching those essentials superlatively well, discarding the non-essentials. We must husband our limited resources carefully and expend them on the items of the highest priority. And unless we do, we run the grave risk of diluting the quality of the education we offer. And unless we do, we will be unable to pay the salaries we must pay if we are to retain our best scholars and to attract to our faculty still others in these days of intense competition for the ablest and most promising intellects. Extensive reorganization of the course structure offers our best hope for making available the substantial sums of money we need to bring our salary scales up to the levels at which they should be, and to provide some of the equipment and other facilities you require to do your best work. Now, matters pertaining to the curriculum are in the province of the faculty. And whether we do what so plainly needs be done rests primarily with the faculty, individually and collectively. It's the clear intention of the trustees and the administration to encourage the faculty to play its proper influential role in establishing university policy. But our experience has been that if we depend upon faculty initiation of proposals to solve significant problems, we often wait in vain. And perhaps we have an answer without recognizing it, for failure to act is action in itself, and failure to decide is a decision of a kind. And I am loath to believe that the faculty of Michigan State University is satisfied with things as they are. And I am loath to believe that you are disinterested in helping to solve the problems confronting our university. I see too many instances of individual, departmental, and college originality and initiative. And as examples, all have seen the real progress being made in the three new colleges of arts and letters, natural science, and social science in thinking through their problems and responsibilities. And there is the constructive self-study of the College of Education as it progresses toward its goal of meeting the needs of our state's school systems. And I do not believe that this university has grown so ponderous that it can no longer move with vigor and determination and speed when called upon to do so. And I much prefer to believe, as I do, that we can retool this university to perform its traditional job according to the new specifications being written in this space age. And the question is whether we will. And whether we will depends on whether you, as faculty officers of this university, will join with the provost in getting done the job that must be done. Provost Erickson has performed superbly well in his most difficult assignment. He is providing academic leadership of the kind we need if this university is to continue to move forward. But the provost's office cannot do this job alone. It must have the sympathetic and enthusiastic support of the entire university faculty. Provost Erickson is perfectly capable of speaking for himself. But I know he will not object to my saying that he subscribes wholeheartedly to the belief that we will of necessity be thrown upon our own resources in resolving many of the difficulties with which we are confronted. The funds derived from state sources are unlikely to be adequate to finance everything that needs to be done. And one obvious thing to do is to turn to outside sources for whatever supplementary aid we can procure. And for the past 4 years, gifts and grants to the university in support of our educational programs have averaged about $9 million per year. That's $750,000 a month, almost $200,000 per week. We would be greatly advantaged if this amount could be increased substantially. The university should and will exert more effort in that direction. But again, we are heavily dependent upon faculty initiative. Most grants come to a university because of the quality and initiative of its faculty. Individual members of the faculty bear responsibility for originating the proposals which are acceptable to the foundations and government agencies. Many things may come to him who waits, but not research grants or other educational subsidies. And Vice President Melder's office is ready and willing to assist faculty members in developing projects for submission to governmental or foundation sources for support. That is one of the most useful and most important roles of his office. And if the project you have in mind is approved by your department and dean, you are free to call upon the Office for Research Development to help you develop it for formal presentation to an appropriate agency. Now I'd like to move in another area for a moment or two. Society asks a university to serve another important function which is understood but faintly, if at all, by the general public. And that function is to serve as a testing place of ideas, a forum of discussion, a laboratory for social, political, economic, and even moral analysis. And society permits the university and its members to surround themselves with certain immunities in order that this function may be performed in freedom from undue outside influence. And it grants special privileges to those who engage in this testing and debating because they perform a vital social function. These immunities and privileges do not exempt the testers and the debaters from their responsibility to serve the social order as they perform their vital roles. What they do must be done in a conscious effort to serve the best interests of society and to contribute to its improvement. And this was one of the functions Cardinal Newman had in mind when he wrote his definition of a university. In recent months, we have seen evidences that substantial segments of the public are not ready to accord to our public universities the freedoms and immunities and privileges they must enjoy if they are to function effectively in this role. And this suggests that we have a job of teaching and interpretation to do. And we would do well not to cry academic freedom at every turn, every time faculty members are frustrated or disappointed, but rather we should teach the true meaning of academic freedom and its importance to the public interest. And we could well point out that universities bear a heavy responsibility to the society that supports them to serve a continuing role as objective critics, free from partisanship and hopefully free from self-interest bias. Where else in our society but at our universities can citizens look for objective appraisal based on facts and logic, free from propaganda bias, and offered freely to all who desire it for their weighing and debate in making the decisions citizens must exercise in a free society? The academic freedom we should justify and defend is that right for the professor in his field of competence to weigh all proposals, regardless of their popularity, to challenge, to question, to propose, and to defend, in order that out of the challenging and defending may come guidance for those who seek it. And the other side of the coin is that we must always recognize that outside of his own field of competence and expertness, the professor is in the same role as any other citizen, and is liable to be called to account for public positions he espouses. Now, ladies and gentlemen, so far I've been emphasizing some of our problems, And we have had our successes too. The new computer to be in operation in April will open up new areas of instruction and research and give us computer facilities as advanced as at any university anywhere. The new cyclotron now under construction will make it possible for the Department of Physics to move into the forefront of physics departments in high energy acceleration studies. The Abrams Planetarium will expedite interest in the teaching of the space sciences. The new chemistry building on which construction will start at the end of this month, when completed, will remove one of the great handicaps under which that department has labored for many years. The science grants recently announced will enable us to move ahead with our program in biochemistry and in biophysics, with incidental benefits to the new Institute of Biology and Medicine. We have in prospect, but with more than reasonable expectations for success, additional sizable grants in other areas, at least one of which promises to make this university the national center for scientific research and teaching in a crucial area of national interest. And as the new science campus advances spectacularly and as is much in the public eye, I would remind all of us that the university is fully conscious of the absolute requirement that we move forward too in the social sciences and in the humanities, and in the old line endeavors of the university, in agriculture and engineering, in home economics and veterinary medicine, in business and in education, in communication arts and in all the rest. We continue to enjoy the warm support and confidence of the people of Michigan who are sending their sons and daughters to us in ever-increasing numbers. The quality of our student body has never been higher, and every year we attract larger numbers of the best students in the nation. And it would be easy to be dazzled by these brilliant displays of achievement and in our momentary blindness to stray from our proper course. And remembering the ordained function of the public university, it would be a tragic error to forget the fundamental importance of teaching and the duty of this university to serve the needs of undergraduate students. Effective teaching is hard to measure, but we can make a greater effort to identify and reward our outstanding and dedicated teachers. And here I would like to restate more strongly than ever before that somehow we must make it a fact that the good teachers are recognized in salary, in promotion, in prestige. And this is easily said, but difficult to accomplish. And it must be demonstrated conclusively that it is the policy of this university to recognize that no one is more important on this campus than the good teacher, and particularly the really distinguished undergraduate teacher. I would be the last to deprecate the tremendous importance of research or graduate instruction. And I have just reiterated that we need to solicit more support for research at Michigan State. And it's a point for pride that we have achieved, at least in part, our ambitions for a strong graduate program at this university. Our graduate programs will become increasingly important objects of concern as the explosion of knowledge continues and as our society becomes more sophisticated in its demands for trained intelligence. But I am concerned, too, lest we be misled into diverting too much of our energies and resources into an unseemly competition between universities for a relatively few top graduate students. The recruiting and subsidizing now rampant at this level are keener than they ever were for potential All-American football players. Now, we want to attract top grade graduate students, and we intend to do so. But I would rather see us put our limited resources into faculty and programs rather than in student subsidies in the belief that if our faculty is distinguished, and our graduate programs are designed to meet the requirements of society itself and the needs of students, together they will attract our full share of the ablest students. And again, I would not de-emphasize graduate study or research when I say that we need to remind ourselves that our first responsibility as a public university is to do the best possible job with the 20,000 or more undergraduate students on this campus. The people of Michigan trust us on this score, and we owe it to them and to the university to be able to tell all who inquire, parents, legislators, alumni, or students, that we are first of all doing the job Michigan State University was established to do, and doing it as well as we can, and doing it with real interest in and respect for every student, doing everything we can to help each student achieve an education to suit his needs and desires, and doing it with human kindness, treating each as an individual, remembering that as our students fail, so have we failed, and only as they can succeed will we succeed. And if we make a real effort to serve the sons and daughters of the people of Michigan in this fashion, in return they will be much more likely to see to it that we have the means to do all of the other things the university must do if it is to discharge its full obligations to Michigan and the nation. Now I'd like to commend again our Honors College and all who make it the challenging experience it is for the able students already. And I am convinced that our students in the Honors College have an unexcelled opportunity for the best undergraduate education offered by any university anywhere. And I say that because I believe it. At the same time we applaud the Honors College, we should recognize that one of the reasons for the marked increase in the ability of our beginning freshmen is the swift improvement of many high school programs in recent years. And here is a possible danger, for as we have the brightest students in our history, we want to be certain that we do not also have some of the most bored. High school seniors become excited at the prospect of coming to Michigan State. Most come full of enthusiasm for learning. We must take maximum advantage of this enthusiasm by being certain that they will be challenged by their first year's courses, and especially their first term's classes. And here I hope we'll continue to look at the articulation between high school course content and our first level courses. If high school programs move up and we do not, we should change to require courses which repeat or duplicate high school content can ruin prospective top students by making them bored and lazy instead of zestful and energetic. Ladies and gentlemen, there is so much to learn, and knowledge expands so rapidly that we should not waste the precious time of able students or of the faculty. And I hope we'll involve ourselves in a continuous program of cooperation and study with selected high schools, looking towards better freshman placement. We should work out the best possible procedure for recognizing where our freshmen stand intellectually when first they set foot on this campus. Now to change tack. Another point we must emphasize is our need to do better than we have in interpreting to the people of Michigan the needs of this university that can be provided for only through legislative appropriation. And when we have done all that we can do within the university through reorganization and increased efficiency, and have secured all available help from other sources, we must turn to the people of this state to provide most of the facilities, the classrooms, the laboratories, the equipment, the libraries, the operating funds. And with the new leadership and new spirit now in evidence in the state capital, there is reason to hope that Michigan will again provide the level of support required to make it possible for this and other universities and colleges to carry forward their vital work in the public service. But here we need the full participation of faculty and students, alumni and friends, in interpreting to the general public the role and purpose of this university. And as the university is complex, its many publics are complex. And the role of interpreting, of promoting understanding of the university grows more and more important. And this is in part the responsibility of every faculty member, of every student, of every employee, of every alumnus. Now our top priority goal in this calendar year, 1963, should be the creation of a situation, a climate on this campus in which everyone who has the welfare of Michigan State University at heart can help move it toward its objectives. We need to find a way to foster intelligent, responsive, progressive faculty initiative. And we need to find ways to encourage those who would employ their intelligence and energies constructively, and frankly, to discourage those who take perverse delight in negativism. It is immutable law that human institutions move forward only when the force exerted by those who are pushing exceeds that exerted by those who are dragging their feet. And universities come to a halt and die, to all intents and purposes, when the two forces balance each other exactly, or when the foot draggers exert the greater force. Michigan State University is not slipping backward, and it is not standing still. This university is in the process of another great forward thrust that can, if we wish it so, place her in the forefront of America's great universities. We made one such great forward thrust immediately following the end of World War II, due in no small measure to the advance planning that had been done and the preparations that had been made for the time when the veterans would come home from the war. And that forward thrust continued for several years. And then came the period when this state had financial problems and emphasis had to be placed on marshaling our reduced resources. We had gains to consolidate and planning to do for the future. And now we are moving into a new period of great forward thrust, much better in a great many ways than 15 years ago. Our faculty is much stronger. We've made good some of our worst deficiencies in buildings and equipment, and more help is on the way. Our student body is of better quality and more serious in purpose. There has been a marked increase in intellectual vigor and activity. We have continued to demonstrate academic leadership in imaginative ways, as exemplified most recently in the creation of a living learning environment in our new residence halls, which is being widely imitated. And the question we should face tonight and tomorrow and the balance of this year is, to what goals should we aspire in this newest renaissance? And I suggest that the goal must not be to ape or copy or imitate other universities. It is but natural to seek the approval of one's peers, but the destiny of this university lies in being her own pioneering self, in being courageous enough to follow her own star, to follow where her own wisdom dictates. This university, our university, has a character and style distinctly her own. She was born as a pioneer And in her maturity, she would disown her heritage if she descended to slavish imitation of others. Her fortune lies, as always, in faithful and obedient service to the society by which she has been so long sustained, and in seeking to continue to merit the approval of those who love and cherish her. As a creature of their making, no other course is open to her. No other service can hope to win as great rewards. There is literally no limit to the advances this university can make if we will subordinate our personal and professional ambitions to its legitimate aspirations. We have all the intelligence we need to move our university ahead a long way, if only it can be enlisted in the effort. We have the intelligence required to solve the problems with which we must contend in the years immediately ahead, if only we will apply it. There is no more time to be wasted. The need is immediate. The challenge is great. The potential rewards for our best and immediate attention to tomorrow's work are almost incalculable. And tonight, I invite each of you to renew your dedication to Michigan State University and pledge with me strength, goodwill, intelligence, all we have to the advancement of her best interests. And I ask this of you as I demand it of myself, in full confidence that our rewards and satisfactions will be commensurate with our efforts. And thank you for coming out on this cold, uncomfortable evening, and good night.
The faculty of Michigan State University, wives and husbands of the faculty, guests, some students, and some state officials have just heard the first annual State of the University address presented by Dr. John A. Hanna, president of Michigan State University, to the assembled faculty here in the auditorium building on the campus of Michigan State University. This has been a presentation of Michigan State University Radio. We return to our studios.